Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. McKay Coppins is a senior political writer at BuzzFeed. He's currently in South Carolina covering the Republican primary race. He's author of The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. It's a really fun read. He's a great writer, and it gives you all kinds of insights that you don't hear many other places about what all these candidates have gone through since the loss of the presidency by Mitt Romney in 2012, how they were positioned, how they have campaigned, what their positions are, in some cases, what their childhoods were like. It goes from the presidential loss in 2012 to September of 2015, when he interviewed hundreds of Republican Party officials and conservative leaders and media figures, family members who have known the current Republican presidential contenders. So he's with us. He's in South Carolina, so we can also shed some light on the race in South Carolina. We'll be concentrating not on those who have dropped out of the race, although the book does cover some of those people, Chris Christie and Paul and others, Scott Walker for that matter. But we will look at those who are strong right now. Donald Trump, of course, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and we'll look at all the people who are in the race right now. And McKay, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Hello, sir.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. You're such a young guy, and you're such a good writer and so prominent in political world. Well, how'd you do this?
I appreciate it. I don't know how prominent I am, but I appreciate the compliment.
Yeah, it's great. Got a lot under the... Imagine what you're going to be like when you're 50, huh?
Yeah, I'll probably be burned out and teaching journalism somewhere at some community college.
Inspiring all kinds of people.
Believe me, no knock against journalism professors. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I understand. Well, before we go to the book, we do need to talk about Nikki Haley's endorsement of Marco Rubio yesterday. You have said that he had a lot of ground to make up to win her over. Mm-hmm. How did he win her over?
Well, it's interesting. If you go back to 2010, when Nikki Haley was first running for governor out here, she was part of this kind of wild and crazy Republican primary. It was a five-way race, all kinds of mudslinging and smear campaigns going on, which is kind of a fixture of South Carolina politics. But as I report, some of the people who are now serving on Rubio's campaign at the time in 2010 were running the campaign of one of her opponents and were widely believed to be behind a kind of rumor about Nikki Haley having an affair with a local blogger that became kind of a big thing that became dominant in that race, which she denied and still denies, and there's no proof that ever surfaced, which is another fixture of these kind of smear campaigns in South Carolina. But because of that, you know, there really are some people who are key figures in the Rubio campaign who are, you know, according to my sources, anathema to Nikki Haley. So they really had to do a lot of work to win over Nikki Haley, win over her team, convince her that Marco Rubio had nothing to do with any of that, of course, because he was running his own race back then. And that, and ultimately she, you know, they pulled it off, which is quite a coup for them. I think that was probably the biggest remaining endorsement in this state, and Marco Rubio is certainly happy to have it.
Yeah, I was watching something last night. I watch a lot of political commentary. I think it was Joe Klein from Time Magazine who said, what has the Democrats shaking in their boots is the possibility of a Marco Rubio-Nikki Haley ticket.
Well, I mean, it is kind of remarkable if you sort of zoom out from the day-to-day political cycle. I just came from a Rubio campaign rally outside of Greenville, South Carolina, where you had Marco Rubio up on the stage with, Marco Rubio being Cuban American, he's standing next to an Indian American governor, a woman, an African American Republican senator from South Carolina, and they're all very young, you know, they're talking about the future of the Republican Party. I mean, if there is if there is a way forward for the party to kind of rebuild a national winning coalition, you've got to believe it's through politicians and leaders and candidates who look like that and have those experiences.
Yes. Well, as long as we're on him, let's continue. You go with Marco Rubio in November of 2012, a young Florida senator who had taken on, this is it, this is why I like your book so much, taken on such a full schedule of stumping that the Romney campaign had actually chartered a small plane to shepherd him around the country. And some days he worked so hard that he worked longer hours than the pilots themselves.
Right. he would often find himself kind of waiting on the runway while they you know, change shifts and he got new pilots. And this is actually, I mean, details like that I think are important because that is representative of Marco Rubio's entire career, which is really built on this sort of boundless energy and ambition and willingness to kind of out-hustle all of his competition. And as I write on the election night in 2012, he was torn between, you know, genuine disappointment that Mitt Romney didn't win, and he had become a big fan personally of Mitt Romney's, but also kind of this excitement, because if you remember watching TV on election night, kind of watching the returns come in, every pundit, especially on the right, every Republican or conservative pundit was saying that that, you know, now with the Republicans kind of in the wilderness, the man to lead them out is Marco Rubio,
right,
this young, dynamic, Spanish-speaking star out of Florida.
Right.
And I report that Marco Rubio is actually at his house in Miami. He had kind of left the campaign trail in the last couple days because his daughter was injured in a minor golf cart accident. And so he was just kind of sitting at home, just obsessively monitoring all the coverage and feeling like he had to do something. He's kind of known among his friends and allies for being, you know, kind of jittery and restless and always feels like he has to be, you know, doing something to have forward motion. And he was calling his aides obsessively and trying to figure out, you know, what should we do to take advantage of this moment? And kind of all of them were like, you know, just calm down. Like, this won't be the last time people mention your name on TV.
No, it sure hasn't been. Another thing that really struck me, I want you to talk about his immigration, working for some kind of reform and where he is now on the issue, and also receiving this letter from his mom, which I thought was very poignant. Some loving advice from the person who cares for you most in the world. Don't mess with the immigrants, my son. Please don't mess with them. They're human beings just like us.
Yeah, it was actually a voicemail that he got from his mom who had tried to call him. And this was after the 2012 election, right as there was kind of this big bipartisan push in the Senate to create this, what they call a gang of senators to basically devise a big comprehensive immigration reform package. And a lot of people wanted Marco Rubio involved in that. For obvious reasons, you know, he's somebody who's experienced immigration firsthand. His parents were immigrants from Cuba, and he was kind of a young rising star on the right. So, but he had kind of resisted it at first, and I write about how one of the political hubs in South Florida is this big hotel, the Biltmore Hotel, where Marco Rubio would spend a lot of time. And a lot of politicians spent a lot of time, Jeb Bush as well. And a lot of the people who, the kind of the political elites who would hang out there, were constantly lobbying him to go get involved in that big immigration reform push. And Rubio was tentative because the politics of it are always tricky for Republicans, and he had dipped his toe in these waters before. But ultimately, you know, the thing that really kind of sealed the deal for him and made him decide he had to do this was this voicemail from his mother. It was actually in Spanish, but translated, basically said, look, you know, don't forget about these immigrants. They're suffering. They're going through things that your father and I went through. And that meant a lot to him. I mean, he talks all the time, even now in his stump speech, about his parents. He really admires his parents. His dad actually died in the final weeks of his Senate campaign, and you know, ultimately decided it was worth the political risk. Though it turned out to be quite a risk, right, for him. And it, when he was met with a very fierce and noisy right-wing backlash, he did ultimately back away from the bill that he helped champion.
Yeah. And if you would, before we move on to Jeb Bush, who I'm not sure how much longer he'll be in this race, what the heck was going on with this repeating? It was just bizarre, that debate performance, and I'm wondering if you think he's moved past that, where he said the same darn thing over and over. It was just incredible.
It was a strange moment.
Yes.
Though I think that a lot of the commentary was wrong. A lot of people said, you know, he sounded robotic, and that, you know, that's a fun joke to make, and I made jokes like that on Twitter. But in fact, I report on this in my book, is the people who know Rubio know that he, in addition to being very ambitious and driven and energetic and hardworking, is also has a propensity to kind of panic in moments of high stress and kind of crisis. And mm-hmm. when he found himself on stage being constantly kind of bombarded with attacks from Chris Christie and others, you know, a lot of the people who have known Rubio for a long time kind of saw something familiar. They saw that kind of jitteriness and that return to, in this case, what he did was kind of retreated to the same talking point over and over and over again. And that is a strain of his personality. And I think that, you know, a lot of people who ultimately, who liked both Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, who kind of in their overlapping political circles in Florida, kind of opted initially to back Jeb Bush because they were worried about that element of Rubio. They felt like he was maybe a little immature, maybe he needed a little more experience, and they saw in Bush kind of a more steady-handed figure.
And maybe Bush should have run in 2012. Maybe that was his year, as he said on Charlie Rose, and you say in the book. Your description, Jeb Bush, after 2012 election, leisurely. That's, you know, that's kind of a good description. He kind of does things, everything leisurely, I would say. Took in election coverage at his stylish million-dollar town home, afflicted with no such eagerness for motion as Marco Rubio. He settled in nicely to the role of elder statesman. He seems to have approached this whole campaign in this really leisurely fashion, hasn't he?
He really does. It's kind of perplexed a lot of people who watched him run for office in Florida, because he was known for, you know, when he ran for governor and he lost in 94 and then ran again in 98 and again in 2002, he was known for being very, you know, a very fierce campaigner. And I think that, you know, a lot of people I talk to say that he didn't ever really, he was never fully on board with this campaign. He felt a lot of pressure. He felt like he was the one who could come in and save the Republican Party as it was kind of descending into chaos. He also felt a lot of pressure from kind of the Bush loyalists, the dynasty loyalists who have been out there for a long time, who really wanted him to run, called him Bush 45. But also, you know, I think that a lot of people have said that Jeb looks miserable oftentimes on the campaign trail, and I think he does. And I think it's just because he expects, to a certain degree, or he, at least at the outset he did, the party would kind of fall in line behind him, right? This is a guy whose dad has been president, whose brother has been president, and at the outset, you know, a lot of the Republican establishment lined up behind him. He got a lot of endorsements. He raised a ton of money early on. And I think he sort of expected that that at least in the primary for the nomination, he would sort of be able to glide above the fray and kind of just receive that nomination. That, of course, didn't end up being the case. And especially lately now on the campaign trail, it seems like he's just, you know, he descends into sarcasm very easily. He gets very bitter. I think that he genuinely does care about his family and his family's legacy, and his brother came out and campaigned for him, and I think he thought that was going to be a sort of watershed moment in this campaign, and it would propel him forward. And so far, the polls don't show that happening, and I think that's a hard thing for a son of a political dynasty to kind of grapple with.
Yeah. So where does he have to place on Saturday to even stay in the race, and why does he have so much money?
Well, he should. I mean, I think that I don't know what place, where exactly he has to place, but I think he has to place ahead of Rubio.
I see.
I think he has to place ahead of Rubio and probably John Kasich, which mm-hmm. is a little bit easier because that's sort of the establishment lane of this primary fight. I mean, the reason he has so much money is because when he formed his super PAC called Right to Rise, he really did look like, you know, he was going to be the establishment standard bearer, and they raised $100 million, which is just an unheard of
wow.
sum of money.
Yeah.
And this was really before he had spent much time campaigning. People just kind of assumed, you know, of course, he's a Bush. He's going to, you know, he knows how to do this, right? And then it turned out that he doesn't, you know, he's not as good at this maybe as a lot of the other candidates. And frankly, this is a really, I think what you said earlier is true. If he had run in 2012, it would have been an entirely different story. But we've reached a point in this election where a lot of things have changed in American politics, and we've reached kind of a fever pitch of anti-establishment anger and kind of this populist uprising on the right that just is absolutely ill-suited to Jeb's whole demeanor, his whole message, and I think that, you know, now we're at the point where his super PAC is just trying to blow through as much money as possible before he drops out.
Right. You know, it's interesting. You give us background information years previous to now, and certainly even to 2012. I was interested in your portrait of Jeb Bush when he was at Andover. You write at the time, the popular political portrait of Jeb is the thoughtful policy wonk with a heart of gold, compassionate conservative, attuned to matters of social justice. The smarter, better, more worthy Bush brother had not yet been painted. And from the description of the pot smoking and the, you know, lackadaisical studies, et cetera, you almost could have been writing about his brother, George W. Bush, couldn't you?
Yeah, it's funny. In our popular imagination in the American electorate, there was this idea that George W. kind of stumbled into the White House. And Jeb, who is the, you know, much worthier,
right, yeah.
smarter Bush, was the one who just never, he just caught a bad break, right? But as it turns out, I mean, look, keep in mind, this is a guy who, he went to Andover because he was basically forced to by his parents, this, you know, very prestigious elite prep school, and spent most of his time there, at least early on, smoking pot, kind of ignoring his classes. There are a lot of people who remember him as a bully, kind of picking on
yeah.
people who were younger, smaller, less, you know, came from less important families. He's not remembered well by many of his classmates. And actually, yeah, didn't really take class all that seriously until very late in his high school career, did a foreign exchange trip to Mexico. And met his now wife, Columba, who at the time he kind of instantly fell in love with. And she loved him. She really liked him, too, and was drawn to him. But she was also put off in later writings and interviews. They talk about this, was put off by what she detected as sort of a kind of rich, spoiled playboy thing that mm-hmm. he seemed to inhabit. And she basically gave him an ultimatum saying that, you know, once he went back to the estates, she said, look, we can keep in touch and I'll marry you one day, but you need to shape up. And he took that very seriously. And the proof is in, you know, the years after that, he breezed through the University of Texas in 2.5 years, got very good grades, basically was trying to prove to his girlfriend and then now wife that he was worthy of her. And it really does seem like she was the one who kind of finally shaped him up.
Yeah. I didn't realize how tall he was until I read some of your books.
6'4".
6'4".
6'4".
Wow.
Yeah, it's funny. If you saw the his brother when he was campaigning with him, a couple days ago down here in South Carolina, the images are pretty remarkable. I mean, he kind of towers above his brother. He's a big guy.
Yeah, he's a big guy. Oh, we want to welcome phone calls. We've yet to talk about Donald Trump. Don't worry, we will get there. Some very interesting things. Our guest devotes a lot of the book to Paul Ryan, actually. So we'll talk about Paul Ryan and we'll talk about Donald Trump. Ted Cruz, we have yet to talk about. And I didn't want to talk too much about those who have left the race because we're in the middle of the race, but certainly we can mention Scott Walker as well. Here's what we're talking about this hour. We're speaking with the author of the so easy to read, filled with all kinds of information you just don't hear in other places, The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. McKay Coppins is our guest, and McKay is senior political writer at BuzzFeed News. He covers national politics and the Republican Party. He was formerly a reporter for Newsweek. Lives in New York and is in South Carolina right now. Here's how you join our conversation. However you want to take the Republican field, that would be, we'd love to hear from you this hour, and you can react to what he has said or ask questions about any of the other candidates. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the candidates who are still in the Republican field, and with the author of the really interesting new book, The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. We started with Nikki Haley's endorsement of Marco Rubio. What do you think of the commentator who said yesterday that would be the Democrats' biggest nightmare? Would be to have that ticket, Marco Rubio and Nikki Haley. We're going to move into Mitt Romney and election night 2012 and Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. But feel free to join the conversation of who's captivating you, who you think have difficulties, what you think about what you've already heard from our guest, who's written a highly informative and very well-written book. McKay Coppins is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Much as I hate to do it, we do need to talk about Donald Trump, who didn't stick around, you write, for the concession speech at the Westin in Boston. He had channeled his talent for self-marketing toward politics, had he ever. And tell me what he was doing in 2012 and when he realized, hey, I could be a contender.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So on election night in 2012, obviously he had endorsed Mitt Romney and had actually been courted by basically every candidate in the Republican field at that time because he had gotten a lot of attention for the conspiracy theory he had been floating and about Barack Obama's birth certificate. Yeah. But by the end of the 2012 election, he had kind of gotten fed up with the Romney campaign, who, after accepting his endorsement in the primaries, basically tried to distance themselves from him because he was not exactly the most the best in surrogate when it came to the general election. So you know, they were trying to distance himself. His ego was wounded, and on the night of the election, when it became clear that Romney was not going to win, he was at the hotel in Boston where he was supposed to be kind of celebrating Romney's victory. When he realized it would be a defeat in a concession speech, he kind of bolted early in his black SUV with his kind of aides around him, and decided instead to do what Donald Trump does best, which is try to steal the spotlight. And on his drive to the airport in Boston, and as he kind of ascended into the sky, he was dictating tweets to his aides about how there needed to be a march on Washington, and this was a travesty, and it was insane that Obama had been reelected, and we need a revolution. And it's interesting because that night, Brian Williams, who was anchoring NBC News' election coverage, took a short detour of the main election coverage to basically announce that Donald Trump had, quote, passed the last exit to relevance. and said, you know, basically dismissed him. And of all the nasty things that were said about Donald Trump that night, that was the one that really got to him, this idea that he wasn't relevant anymore. And basically what he did is, you know, over the next few years is very meticulously court the kind of far right fringe of the Republican Party by giving interviews to right wing websites like Breitbart News, you know, courting conservative talk radio hosts, you know, floating one conspiracy theory after another. And for the first kind of couple years, most of the Republican Party leaders and kind of party elites didn't pay much attention to Trump, and that goes for the media too, including me, who just sort of assumed that he was a sideshow. And, you know, he was once again right. floating this idea that he would run for president in 2016, but he'd been doing that basically every few years since 1987, if you go back, and people had kind of gotten to the point where they didn't believe him anymore. The one thing about Donald Trump, and I spent time with him working on this profile for BuzzFeed, and there's a whole story about that in the book, but, you know, the one thing that I was most struck with about Trump is just the extent to which he is, you know, the most important thing in his life is making sure that he can command a spotlight when he wants it, right? Mm-hmm. And when people start to ignore him or dismiss him as kind of a joke, it really gets to him. And when, you know, he realized that the smart set in Washington and the political media and the Republican Party establishment was treating him like a sideshow, he decided that the only way to prove them wrong was to run for president, and he obviously has proven all of us wrong.
So why didn't the media treat him more as a sideshow in the earlier days of this campaign, and maybe we wouldn't have what we have now?
Well, I would actually contend that they did treat him like a sideshow. The problem is that they gave him so much attention, right? It's funny because if you look back at the early coverage back in August, July, August, September, he rocketed to the top of the polls, and everyone kind of dismissed that as just name ID, right? Everybody knew his name, and the voters weren't really tuned in yet. But he has this knack for just every day being able to concoct some new way to hijack the news cycle. And whether it's saying a new outrageous thing or proposing something outlandish or picking a fight on Twitter with somebody, he does this every day. And I think that a lot of the political media and a lot of the press thought that it was kind of, you know, it was okay to cover him so extensively because, look, he's, you know, he's an entertainer, he's a provocateur, he obviously has a lot of supporters, and that says something about American politics. But I do think that at some point we as, and I include myself here in the political press, we just kind of gave ourselves too much of a break when it comes to giving him free airtime. I think that Donald Trump didn't have to spend any money on television commercials for the first 6 months of his campaign says a lot about how much work we in the media did for him.
Yeah, it sure does. Let's go to phone calls. We have many coming in for you. Let's go to Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, yes. I was looking at the news on the web today that the Southern Poverty Law Center has actually declared the Republican Party a hate group, or at least a megaphone for a hate group, and is partially responsible for the rise in the number of hate groups, which I think is up to 1,900 in the United States at this point.
They said the whole party, the whole Republican Party?
Yes, and I've been looking it up as I've been waiting to get on, and I've seen different reports saying that the Southern Poverty Law Center has either declared the Republican Party itself as a hate group, or it has acted as a megaphone for hate groups and is partially responsible mm-hmm. for the rise of those hate groups.
McKay.
Sorry. Are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, from what I understand, they released a report saying that the Republican Party is responsible for a growth in the number of conservative hate groups, noting that radical groups grew 14% in 2015, and they chalk that up to the influence of people like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. This actually gets, though, at a kind of one of the main themes of my book, and I think of Republican politics of the last several years, which is that what we used to call the Republican establishment, which was kind of a loose coalition of party committees and corporate interests and kind of Washington officials, has really lost control of its party. Mm-hmm. The establishment just doesn't have the influence that it used to. And in its place, this kind of right-wing, combative, counter-establishment has sort of risen up that has its own media ecosystem, has its own very well-funded political groups, Tea Party groups, and they command a tremendous amount of influence in the party. Now, I wouldn't call all of those hate groups myself, but they certainly incentivize a lot of the what people, you know, would regard as hateful talk coming from Donald Trump and maybe other candidates. They incentivize that kind of stuff by amplifying it, by celebrating it, by touting those candidates and those politicians as sort of you know, champions of their cause. And I mean, look, when Donald Trump came out and proposed the ban on all Muslim immigrants to this country, or stopping all Muslims from coming into the country, I mean, anyone across the normal ideological spectrum dismissed that as absurd. But there was an element of the conservative media and an element of the conservative base, which is now very well organized, that celebrated that, and at the end, you know, Trump benefited greatly from that. So I think that might be part of what kind of the Southern Poverty Law Center is getting at.
Thanks, Tom. Louise in Dodgeville, hi.
Hi. I read something online about old political strategy. It was kind of like, how do we get the independents and the people in the middle? That's how we're going to win an election. Mm-hmm. And now that because of partisan politics, the middle is really shrinking. So the new strategy is, okay, we just have to get more people to the polls. So I just was curious about that, what you thought of it, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Louise.
Yeah, that's a great it's a great point, and it really is one of the dynamics shaping this race. There used to be kind of a broad, you know, winnable number of voters, a swath of the electorate that could vote either Democrat or Republican, and they changed depending on the election, depending on the candidates, and that was what the whole, you know, general election came down to: who can persuade that middle. Now it's what a lot of political strategists call a base election, which is the whole idea. And Ted Cruz actually has been talking about this for years. You know, I've seen him give speeches to party activists and all sorts of people making this point that the way to win is to nominate a candidate who so excites your base that you'll bring millions and millions of conservative voters or liberal voters out to the polls that wouldn't otherwise vote. I mean, I would hesitate to say that's really how you win a general election. I guess time will tell. But the best way to test that theory is for the Democrats to nominate Bernie Sanders and the Republicans to nominate somebody like Ted Cruz. And then I guess we can find out if that's really the way to win an election.
Mm-hmm. More on Ted Cruz in a moment. Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
Before all this got started, I heard of analysts talking about the trap that the Democrats could get in by thinking that they were going to purely get win another presidential election via the changing demographics, and that if they really relied on that as a strategy and didn't take into account, for lack of a better phrase, somebody you'd like to have a beer with or somebody you'd like to have in your living room, that you would you could really lose the election that way, because people would defy their demographics for a candidate that they liked. And with what's left of this group on the Republican side, who do you think the Democrats should be worried about from that perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that you know, when Barack Obama won in 2008, he brought a lot of voters out to the polls who don't typically vote as often, and it was dubbed by a lot of politicos as the coalition of the ascendant, and that included people of color, younger people. Kind of the demographics in this country that are growing rapidly. That said, I think it is true that you know, neither Hillary Clinton nor Bernie Sanders should bank on absolutely winning a general election like that. Certainly, I think Marco Rubio, who is young, you know, fluent Spanish speaker, is somebody who could theoretically make a dent in, you know, luring away a lot of the Obama coalition. People say that among the running mates, Tim Scott, who is an African-American Republican senator in South Carolina, Nikki Haley, any adding those people to the ticket, you know, you also can't bank on just having a minority on the ticket means you win minorities, obviously. But I think that it would be a mistake for Democrats to assume that you will just automatically win all the voters that Obama won.
Let's talk a little bit more. Thank you, Scott, so much for your call about Ted Cruz, who's doing pretty well and has done well so far. This is really interesting. It's one of the reasons that your book is so readable. The religious elements, which he has courted, and he's gotten a lot of these voters, evangelical Christians, the way he roams the stage, the way he courts people, and talks about a religious revival, populist revolution. You say that you say that somebody who worked with him in the Solicitor General's office, I think, said he was never particularly religious, as far as I knew. One aide who worked closely with him, Texas Solicitor General's office, said, "I'm not even sure he went to church." And you quote somebody else, this arms out, palms open pose, something that Cruz had picked up from watching the TV evangelist Jimmy Swaggart. Really? Really?
Yeah, that came from an advisor who worked on Ted Cruz's 2012 Senate campaign. And said that Cruz had kind of mastered the gestures of the televangelist Jimmy Swaggart, and when he gives speeches, especially to evangelical crowds, will kind of mimic those gestures. Nothing can be to, you can talk to one thing I learned about this book is you can talk to 300 people as I did, and you still can't come away with an absolute definitive take on what's inside the minds of these various candidates. But I will say that a lot of people who've known Cruz over the years, including, you know, more recently in his career and way back or in his early life, have been seriously skeptical of the kind of religious overtones of his campaign, saying that he's never been an extremely devout person, and that, you know, this is kind of a very calculated move to attract evangelical voters, which, by the way, has been working so far.
Sure has. So why is it you hear again and again and again, nobody likes him? Is it true nobody likes him?
Well, yes and no, right? I mean, look, I had a pretty hard time finding, you know, people who had great things to say about him, regardless of their politics. Though I did find some. The thing about Ted Cruz that I think a lot of people don't quite understand is that he's somebody who, all the way back to his very early childhood, had a hard time fitting in. He's always been, I think, smarter than his average classmate. Mm-hmm. He is extremely bright.
He is smart.
And has a, you know, so part of that was, you know, he had a hard time getting along with people. He also is just kind of he's come off as very arrogant or condescending, and that kind of haunted him all the way back to high school. But then at the same time, you have the situation where his parents, and I write about this in the book, even when he was very, very young, his father, who's a Cuban immigrant and kind of found God when he was young after having Ted, would on an almost daily basis kind of take Ted onto his knee or have these talks with him and tell him that God had destined him for greatness, that he was he had been set apart by God to do great things. And so when you have that, you know, from a very young age, you both have a hard time fitting in with your classmates and your peers, and then at home you have your father telling you that you're destined for greatness.
Really?
It creates a very unique kind of psychic cocktail that I think we see now playing out on the presidential stage.
Yeah, and everybody who's listening, I'm sure, had images of our own parents wondering what it would be like to have our parents do that to us. Whoa! Oh, it would have to make some kind of impact, wouldn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah. Let's welcome more phone calls. We're speaking this hour with the author of the just released The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. McKay Coppins is with us. He's senior political writer at BuzzFeed News. He covers national politics and the Republican Party, was formerly a reporter for Newsweek magazine. He's a young guy who's in South Carolina right now covering of course, the primary there. We have some lines open if you've been trying to get through. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook, please put your comments there. We'd love to read them after the show or during the show, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We need to talk a little bit about Paul Ryan, because you do talk about him extensively in the book and describe what he was like on the night of November, the election, when he lost, along with Mitt Romney, and what kind of vice presidential candidate he was, why he decided for that role for himself, and how disillusioned he is by politics.
Yeah, he became kind of a really compelling character to me, and even though he didn't end up running for president, and most of my characters are, you know, presidential candidates, I couldn't quite let go of him, because he almost seems kind of like the heart of this this book in a lot of ways. He obviously was Mitt Romney's running mate, and he's somebody who idolized Jack Kemp. Jack Kemp was a self-proclaimed bleeding heart conservative, you know, very influential congressman, and was Bob Dole's running mate. And Paul Ryan, when he was tapped to join Mitt Romney's campaign, really tried. He wanted to bring the conservative message to a much wider audience than the campaign was focused on. He wanted to go into inner cities and campaign there. He wanted to pitch their message to Black voters and Latino voters. And the campaign just totally shut it down. They said, you know, it doesn't make any political sense. It would be a waste of time. It would be off message. And Paul Ryan became really frustrated, and in the end actually was able to convince them to let him give one big speech focused on poverty. And it was toward the end of the campaign. It was after Mitt Romney's 47% video had leaked, and much to Ryan's dismay, I think that he kind of decided that was the only reason that they were letting him even do this. But he gave this speech, and there was a moment backstage that I write about in the book that kind of informs a lot of Ryan's politics now, where he met with a bunch of, you know, ministers and people who had worked at halfway houses and counseled drug addicts. These were not necessarily conservatives. These were just people who worked with the poor, basically. And at the end of that meeting, they had a long discussion about what, you know, what politicians can actually do to help those people. At the end, they all circled around him and laid hands on him and prayed. And it was kind of an epiphany for him. He kind of had a spiritual awakening after that. And after he lost the election, he called up one of his aides and said, you know, this is the next thing I have to focus on. This is a man who's built his entire political career on introducing budgets that kind of slash federal programs.
Yeah.
And so it's a pretty remarkable transformation for him. But I write in the book that he spends the next couple of years going, you know, quietly visiting these inner city areas, mostly without cameras or reporters in tow, and kind of meeting with people who were working at the grassroots level to combat poverty and its various, you know, results and consequences in these neighborhoods. And he actually let me come along on one of these trips in Indianapolis. And it was fascinating to watch him, because he was clearly uncomfortable at moments. He was in a mostly Black church in inner city in Indianapolis. And, you know, they would sing hymns and do these, you know, kind of very fiery speeches. And he's a Catholic, and he was trying to kind of sway along with the rest of the congregation, but couldn't quite get the hand of it. But it was just fascinating. And now you actually, you know, he became Speaker of the House, but where my narrative leaves off, he was actually eyeing the exits altogether. He had kind of convinced himself that, you know, no matter what, after spending 2 years on these kind of tours of poverty-stricken cracks and crevices of America, he was losing his faith that there could be any bipartisan consensus on how to really address those issues. Of course, then he became Speaker of the House, and now the big question is whether he'll you know, all these, this spiritual epiphany he had, whether it will actually lead to him doing something. And that's what I think a lot of people are waiting to see.
That's fascinating. Let's go to phone calls again. Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My only real comment or question for your guest is that as we become more extreme, we're finding that, you know, these guys might get elected from the base, but that also makes it very hard to govern. Where should we be in terms of our electing our government officials who are not only good at from the getting elected from the base side, but also to govern after they're elected? Thanks so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Yeah, it's a great, I mean, that's a great point. And you know, it almost transcends ideology to me, because I think you could have a very, very progressive president or a very, very right-wing president who if they're temperamentally, you know, inclined to reach out across the aisle to make compromises, to build deals, to pass legislation, to solve problems, it doesn't matter what their ideology is, as long as they're willing to do that. I mean, of course it matters in terms of where they're coming from, but there's this kind of idea that you have to elect a moderate to be able to do that, and I don't think that's necessarily true. That said, some of the candidates who are doing best with the conservative base or the Republican base right now are Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. And both in very different ways are doing things that will make it, if they become president, will make it incredibly difficult to, you know, engage in goodwill negotiations with Democrats on the Hill. Ted Cruz, because his kind of entire political career is built on the government shutdown of 2013, where he actively led the crusade to defund Obamacare that, according to my sources in his camp, knew would never succeed, but it was good for him. And then Donald Trump, you know, every day saying disparaging things about immigrants or Muslims. It's going to be very difficult if he becomes president to make the deals that he's so fond of touting in his business career. Mm. But I do think that that's an important point. I think we need to be looking to whatever your ideology is, you need to be looking for candidates who are actually interested in governing.
Deb in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi there. Yes, I would like to make a comment here. The Republican Party is, I believe, becoming too extreme. Ted Cruz especially reminds me of that Kool-Aid cult leader, David Koresh. His whole affect the party to what he's saying. It's follow me, and it's ridiculous. It's getting way, way, way out of line. But thank you. I just want to make that comment.
All right, Deb. Do you see a cult kind of leader in him?
That's actually remarkably, I think, the third or fourth time somebody has compared Ted Cruz to David Koresh.
Huh. I hadn't heard that before.
I am not willing to go that far, but
right.
I see what he's saying. He does have an effect on his voters and on his followers in Congress, as kind of the right-wing Tea Party congressman, and making them go along with whatever he's saying, even if it seems to defy political realities.
Mm. Thanks, Deb. Terry in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I was... I want to float this theory that Trump is running trying to expose the Republican Party for what it is. A lot of bigots and hate mongers. You think that's plausible, that he would be trying to expose them, the party?
That he's doing it deliberately?
Yeah, deliberately to expose him,
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting theory. It's funny. I've heard, and maybe this goes along with that. I've also heard the theory, kind of conspiracy, that he's a Democratic plant. That the Clintons kind of lured him into the race to kind of blow up the Republican primary process. I'm not inclined to think that that's true. I think he's picked a lane. But one thing I will say is that I don't think Donald Trump is particularly ideological, and I also don't think that he particularly believes a lot of the things he says. I think he is somebody who, his theology is branding and marketing, and that's what he believes in most deeply. And he has figured out ways to you know, to manipulate the media to get attention and to, you know, maintain a very high place in the Republican presidential primary polls, and he's saying the things that he needs to. I don't know necessarily how much of it he believes, but it's certainly working for him.
What a year. Thank you so much, McKay, for being with us. And we hope you'll join us again. We do an All Things Political thing every Monday here, and we'd love to have
anytime.
You join us. Great. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for writing the book.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. We didn't get to a whole lot of what's in the book. It's a good read. It's The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. McKay Coppins is a senior political writer at BuzzFeed News. He covers national politics and the Republican Party. He used to work for Newsweek. He was listed as one of Forbes' 30 Under 30 in the year 2012 and included on Politico's list of 2012's breakout reporters. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this program, and thanks to Kendra Smith for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. We're next with you on Monday of next week, and it will be All Things Political. Nevada caucuses for the Democrats, South Carolina primary for the Republicans on Saturday, so we'll have a lot to talk about again next week. Thanks for listening to this hour. Great shows ahead.